Welcome to The Rink, a hockey podcast by hockey bloggers for hockey fans. I'm James Tapley Grayley, and along with Tom Luongo, it's our year-end special, or at least if you can call it a special. We're going to talk about the top stories that we feel impacted the NHL and hockey this year, and maybe throw in a few other things to boot. That's all coming up next on The Rink. Well, we have to follow along with the rest of the media world and do our little year-end special. I kind of think of it as a year-end non-special. We're only on episode 14 of The Rink. It's not like we can say, hey, look at our entire year at this point. But I've actually been looking forward to doing this, a little year-end special about how we're seeing this season so far. And I'm looking at I personally have a few stories on tap for, you know, just how this year has been going, or just the season has been going. I think it's had a lot. This has been a pretty active year considering how boring the off season was.
Oh yeah, well, nothing could have been worse than this last off season. And yeah, I mean, if it's not a year end special for us, then we can always look at it as like the end of the semester or end of the quarter special. It is, yeah. You know, if we're apprentice journalists, then we're selling, you know, how's that? We'll do it.
I don't know. I'm just looking at, thinking of you and I and thinking special.
In the special, you know, special needs sense,
special,
I guess.
Way, yeah.
Special Olympics guy.
So I've got a few things on my mind from this season. I don't know. Should I start us off or you want to start us off?
You go ahead and start.
All right, I'll start us off. I'm going to say what I think is my top number one, you know, story of the season year so far for the last. So I'm going to start off. I know that this may seem like something that only I would care about or Avalanche fans would care about, but I think actually it does have a little bit bigger impact overall in the league. Is first on my list is Joe Sakic sticking his hand into a snowblower. Now, the snowblower itself really isn't the big impact at this point, but looking at, exactly. If Super Joe versus Super Snow isn't the big story as much as one of the storied players in the NHL right now, one of what I would think of as the best and the brightest, people look at Joe Sakic and think, you know, here's a nice guy, here's a good player, a guy who's honorable on the ice, all of that stuff, who's staring down the end of his career. And at the same time, he hemmed and hawed in the offseason as to whether or not he would actually play this year, which meant that in a cap world for the NHL, they had to hold out money for him. Right. And I think that's kind of where the impact of all of this is, you know, where are teams looking, what are teams looking at when they have a player that they want, that they think should be on board for their team, that, like the Ducks with Timo Solani, any of these franchise players that decide I'm going to hold out and money is reserved for them, it has a huge impact on a team these days.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, and actually, the Sakic story is actually indicative of what you were saying, of a larger issue with just about every player over the age of 35 who's established himself. Why do they even need to play the first half of the season? I think it was brought up. I heard that from somebody. I think it was on the Hot Stove a couple weeks ago or whatever. And it's the truth. At the end of the day, you've got Matt Sundin, Joe Sakic, Timo Solani. Last year you had Scott Niedermeyer. And all of them just don't feel the need to show up for training camp and put in the full season's work. And, you know, that's the story that's becoming – that's what's starting to overtake everything else. And then – the ignominious way looks like Sakic's career may end is, you know, just it's like the ultimate irony in a sense, that, you know, here's a guy who's left it all on the ice and always and has always, you know, played with to the utmost of his ability and could eventually be done in by some back spasms and then eventually a snowblower. And you just don't want to see that happen to someone like him. And then, you know, the flip side of it, you've got somebody like Matt Sundin, as we talked about last week, you know, signs with the Vancouver Canucks for what reason? You know, when you look at the Western Conference, Vancouver is not, you know, the best vehicle for him to, you know, finally notch that last trophy on his you know, put that last trophy up on his shelf.
Well, certainly not without Roberto Luongo, but you know, right. That yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, we've talked about Sundin. Everybody's talked about Sundin to death and analyzed Sundin, you know, to the nth degree. Myself, I don't think that a high priced center is what's going to save that team, but you know, that's just me. You know, you're right. They held out a lot of money, and they kind of paid the price in the early season for him. And luckily, they got their payoff, because if he hadn't come to the Canucks, what were they going to do? Not a lot.
Yeah, especially since now it looks like Michael Nylander's now off the market with the Caps. You know, I don't see a lot of – there's just not a lot of quality. I don't know how many really quality centermen are going to be out there. If it looks like Nashville's hanging around for a playoff spot, so Jason Arnott's not going to be available at the deadline, which is rapidly approaching. It's only 6 weeks away now.
Really, it's only 6 weeks away.
Oh yeah, remember God, they moved it up. Remember they moved it up earlier in the year, so it should be around the middle of February. Wow. So middle to late February, so 6-7 weeks from now. Maybe 6 weeks, maybe a little early, but yeah, so 6-7 weeks from now. It's definitely before March. So. You know, we're getting close. So,
holding out that cap space for one player is I mean, we're starting to see that as kind of the norm. The Ducks did it. Right. Teams that were looking for Sundin and the Avs had to do it for Joe Sakic. Now, not that I'm not complaining about. I think that Joe Sakic deserves a job with the Avalanche any day of the year. I mean, they should, if the guy wants to play when he's 72. Then they should make him an offer. You know, I mean, it's hey, they're doing it for Chris Chelios, so why not?
Well, yeah.
But you know, still, I have to throw the Chelios jab in there somehow. That's just
gotta take your shots when you can get them, dude. Come on.
But you know, it does have a big impact on the league now that, like you said, their teams are waiting for players to come around whenever they're ready. And that's an interesting thing. You look back at how it used to be. Players were almost like indentured servants. And if you wanted to play, you played on the team's terms. And now, even in the cap world, even when the players are having to hold out money for the escrow payments, they're having to submit to the cap world, the players are really still in control. And this kind of proves that.
Oh, of course. They're the talent. At the end of the day, they're going to be in control of it. Once they have the ability to choose where it is that they want to play, they have all the leverage. Yeah. In any individual player's contract now, the league ultimately has, I think, ultimate leverage in labor management negotiations, but that's a different story for a different day, and we maybe get into that next summer when we start staring down the pike at the first option year for the CBA.
Yeah. Well, believe it or not, I think that you and I are going to get into it in about my number one pick for what the story of the year I think was. But that's just I think that actually has a lot to do with what I think the number one story of the year is. But
yeah, well, speaking of bad player decisions, I think story number two has got to be Sean Avery.
Oh yeah,
you know, and it goes all the way back into the last year's playoffs, right? Mm-hmm. With the Marty Brodeur stick swinging incident, and you know, and him not coming back to the Rangers because, well, he was not wanted back, and then signed by Dallas, and then he hits the wall with what was a very calculated and extremely poorly executed piece of.
You know, you have to wonder with stuff like that happens like that if the player when it comes out of their mouth when they do something when anybody in these situations it happens and then all of a sudden the impact suddenly goes in a totally different direction if they're just completely snowballed. I mean, Sean Avery's one of those guys who seems to always be cool under fire, but at the same time, there's no way he could have seen this coming.
I think he thought he was going to get away with this one like he's gotten away with everything else in the past. And we, you know, we've talked about it in relation to him before. He's a guy that's always gotten positive feedback for doing things like this, and therefore, you know, why should he expect to get anything other than positive feedback, or at least not negative feedback this time?
Right. Well, going back to what, you know, the start of it all, what you said with the stick swinging incident that essentially led to the Avery rule now, which, you know, you can't just look at the goaltender and swing your stick in the face. I saw an interesting bit about it in a place I didn't expect it. The New York Times Sunday Magazine had their top ideas, their best ideas, and the ideas issue of 2008. And what was in the S section but Sean Avery? And the concept being instant taboo, that here was a thing that wasn't bad and it wasn't ruled against, and then all of a sudden, as soon as it happened, the rule was made. And right. And you know what? I was actually on a flight and looking through the issue, and all of a sudden there's Sean Avery and the Sean Avery rule in the New York Times Magazine. And we think that, you know, we think to ourselves, of course, hockey doesn't have much impact on the rest of the world. It's our sport. It's it is a niche sport oftentimes. But it was an interesting place to see it. I guess Sean Avery has a little more reach than we thought he did.
Yeah, a little farther reach than Maxim, mm-hmm. I guess.
or what was it? Vanity Fair, Cosmo, whatever he was trying to dress up for. Right. I think part of the interesting deal is that he's basically fired from the Dallas Stars, mm-hmm. without actually being fired. They're kind of honoring his contract, but he's not going to be back, and they've never really said how they're going to look at that.
Welcome to the world of guaranteed contracts.
Yeah.
He doesn't, you know, they have to pay him, you know, under normal circumstances, he would be fired, and that would be the end of it, and they'd be given a severance pay and to keep his mouth shut or whatever, and then he'd be gone. His severance pay in this case is to get paid for the next 3 years.
Right. So, and you have to wonder, you know, if that's the end of his career. Money. What's he going to do? He can't necessarily go play if he's going to be paid because of insurance and all of those sorts of things. And
someone would have to pick up his contract for him to play with anybody else. And yeah. the secondary story, of course, with all of this is, you know, the story of Brett Hull as executive, mm-hmm. and how the Dallas Stars as an organization have kind of hit rock bottom, seeing as they're pretty much, you know, rock bottom in they're not rock bottom in the Western Conference anymore, but they're certainly not any good either. No. But, you know, they've played better of late, especially since the Avery incident, you know, came down the pike. They're 6-3-1 in their last 10, only 13th in the conference now.
Yeah, Sean Avery's next Halloween costume that he's going to be wearing is that of a scapegoat. It's just the way he is. Yeah, I don't blame him. I kind of laugh at the NHL in a way because they're sending him to counseling. And I want to talk about the number one way to drop Sean Avery's contract value is to send him to counseling and anger management counseling. There is no other reason to hire Sean Avery other than the fact that he needs counseling.
Exactly. Well, it's nothing more than show. This whole concept of people needing anger management, I don't even want to get into that. That gets into something. I gets into some specific ills with this particular society that I just don't want to go into right now.
Oh man, we've done that before. We can't.
Yeah, you and I don't want to do that. That would be bad.
I have a flight to catch tomorrow.
That's for off camera, off record or whatever.
We have to think about, you know, like how they're going to counsel him and then come back to be the player that he was before. I mean, that's just not going to happen. I think the funniest thing was when people were saying that Sean Avery needs help, and these were people in the hockey world, and the fans are saying, yes, he does. We've known that, and we've been telling you that.
Yeah, and Sean Avery needs help, and it's the fact that, and like you said, it's the very reason that he needs help is what makes him effective at his job.
And that's the exact reason
when he's on the ice.
And that's the exact reason that Brett Hull wanted him in the first place. And
exactly.
You might as well just slap a sales tag on him. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, I really liked one of yours. One of your top stories is kind of the resurgence of the original six teams, at least at the very least five of them right now.
Well, I mean, even Toronto, when you look down the list, even Toronto was better than everybody expected. Mm-hmm. And now with, of course, the other soap opera having been resolved last month, the Brian Burke soap opera finally going, will he, won't he, will he, won't he, with taking the job in Toronto, which everybody under the sun knew that was going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
You've got storylines that matter in every one of the original six cities. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I don't think for a second that the NHL as an organization was trying to make this happen at the expense of other markets. And just don't kid yourselves. It's good for the league. It's good for hockey. It's good for everybody except, you know, the teams that have to get marginalized in the process. And that's just the way it's going to be.
Right.
But you've got the Rangers are very solid in New York with Chris Drury and that story there. You've got the Boston Bruins that are absolute beasts.
You were telling me what their goal differential was right now?
Yeah, they're plus 50 freaking two.
Oh, my God. That's just
100, and that's more goals for and fewer goals against than anybody in the league. I don't count the Minnesota Wild because they don't actually play hockey. they play some mutant thing that, you know, they play some mutant kind of exercise and defensive shell. They don't actually play hockey.
You can't score a lot of goals when you're skating backwards.
Yeah, you know, they just, yeah, exactly. So, and even their forwards skate backwards. So, and the sad part, and the interesting part about the fact that the Bruins are 9-1 in their last 10, they've lost one game at home in regulation out of 15, is the fact that the Chicago Blackhawks are 9-0-1 in their last 10, coming into the possibly postponed due to hot weather Heritage Classic.
Yeah. You know what? And, you know what? Actually, I love that about that story is that it really isn't anybody else but the media wondering if it's going to be postponed. Nobody else has said anything, so I think that was just a story that caught fire. I'll tell you, if there's a, I'm gonna be kind of a dork here for a second. If you want to go for the smart set in Chicago and sell the Chicago Blackhawks, I have their new slogan: instead of truth will out, youth will out. The young people are really taking over. How many was it? Like 19 goals for Sharp right now?
Sharp, the Sharp, Kane, Taves. This is a young team. It was Brent Seabrook, Bufflin. I mean, it's a great example of how you stockpile high draft picks and bring them along and let them grow up and then surround them with the right amount of veteran talent, and including, believe it or not, that ridiculous contract they gave Brian Campbell, but it's paying off.
And not only that, who was there a single person in the hockey world that thought that it was a good idea to keep hold of Hobby Bullen?
Right.
No, nobody. Everybody said trade him, trade him, trade him. They're still saying trade him, and this team is on fire. Why would you
do it? And QA is now potentially on the block and not Hobby Bullen. But I don't think either of them are going anywhere. If the team is playing this well now,
damn thing. Yeah.
I would change anything right now. You have two great goaltenders to go into the playoffs with in case one falters. They both have playoff experience. Hobby Bullen's got a cup. You know, why would you change anything? If anything, you go for a little bit extra. If you've got any cap room at all, and I don't know that they do. I don't think they have much, if any, that you try and add a little bit of veteran grinder presence, PK grinder presence, to help stabilize the locker room at the trade deadline. But that's about it. You just let them run, and if they don't, you know, and if they falter in the first or second round of the playoffs, so what? The kids get plenty of good playoff experience, and they're going to need it.
Hell, just making it right now for that team would be amazing, and they're going to make it.
They're going to make it.
There are two locks to me in that division, and that's the first time in a long time that's been the case.
You know, yep.
There's always been that straggler that Predators in the eighth place, or the Blues maybe squeaking in, you know, over the last several years. Now there's an actual competition going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially with Nick Lidstrom looking particularly human.
Human,
I think,
yeah.
I think particularly injured, if I remember correctly. Nick Lidstrom is no longer the best defenseman in the Central Division. His name is now Shea Weber.
Wow, so. We're just inviting attack upon attack right now against us. And, you know, I don't blame you. He was out the other night, which the Avalanche beat the Red Wings in the shootout. A game I talked about on my blog a little bit, which, you know, even though the Red Wings got a point, it's still an absolute victory for the Avalanche, because who cares if the Red Wings get a point? They're going to make the playoffs. We all know they're going to make the playoffs.
Right. Yeah, I haven't actually had a chance to really watch the Red Wings, but everything I've heard is, I've checked some of the Detroit blogs and whatnot, and they're really not very happy with the bottom half of their defense corps. And then if Lidstrom's not, you know, playing all world machine like perfect hockey like he has done for the last, I don't know, generation, you know, that's a defense that is now got some issues in front of what is, you know, honestly average goaltending.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean it's Conklin is on fire at times and not on fire at other times, and Osgood, you know, he's always needed a good defense in front of him, but mm-hmm. not that I really want to take a lot away from him. He has won a Stanley Cup. Yeah, you know, I mean he's on his own. I mean, yeah, it's not his fault that he's had excellent defensemen in front of him. You know,
no,
he hasn't done great.
Yeah, I wouldn't put either of those guys in elite. You know, they're not elite goaltenders. They're at times, and like they're like all other what I would consider second tier goaltenders. They have the capability for a short period of time to play amazingly well, and that amazing period of their life may happen during a playoff stretch. It may happen in December, you know, January. A la Brian Boucher from a few years ago, five straight shutouts, whatever the hell it was. You know, everybody has that potential. Most starting goaltenders in the NHL have that potential to be great for anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks. You know, and Osgood has happened to have done it now twice.
In the right time.
During the playoffs. Yeah. So, you know, I'm not going to take anything away from him. But,
no, me neither.
Yeah, I'm not going to handicap the Western Conference playoffs at this point. Not with the way San Jose and Chicago have been playing. Not with the way Anaheim is you know, right at that ship. Just not going to do it.
Yeah, and even though we have the, you know, we make fun of the as much fun as we make of the Canucks and the whole Sundin thing, there's a lot of potential there right now. And mm-hmm. when that potential gets realized, we'll see what really happens.
Yeah, if Luongo stays healthy for the rest of the season, and you know, Luongo's as long as Vancouver can stay in the hunt, and right now they're out of that pack between 34 and 39 points. They're just above that pack, and there are, you know, what, seven teams within 5 points of each other in the West. Phoenix in seventh place, Nashville in eighth, Colorado, Minnesota, Los Angeles, Edmonton. We make fun of Dallas and Columbus. Dallas is only 2 points out of a playoff spot.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but Vancouver's, you know, above that. There are 41 points, 36 games played. The point that that Ryan Miller made over the summer was, you know, it was always in the last couple of years, it's been the guys that didn't get a lot of work during the regular season that were able to get hot during the playoffs. And whether it was through injury, in his case, and Marc-Andre Fleury, with the two examples he used, maybe this year it's going to be Luongo. That, you know, him not playing 15 or 20 games will have him rested well enough that when he comes back and he gets into his groove, that he'll have enough in the tank to carry the Vancouver Canucks on his back.
Yeah. We'll see. Maybe they were riding him too hard before, and now it's right. time to back off a little bit.
It's the same thing with Marty Brodeur. In the last couple of years, Marty Brodeur's played so many games in order just to get the Devils to the playoffs, to get them into a decent seeding in the playoffs, that by the time they got to the playoffs, he was worn out.
Yeah.
So if Brodeur comes back in time and the Devils look for all the world like they're going to make the playoffs again, they're in a very solid sixth position in the East, then I don't see any reason why Brodeur can't come back rested and take one more, you know, crack at the can. So it'd be interesting.
Well, my number one story this year for the NHL this season so far, I guess, has been the KHL. To me, the KHL, whether they've actually realized being a threat so far or not, for a league that is only halfway through their very first season, has had absolutely the most impact on the NHL from an outside source. It's just
since the WHA.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and going back that far, I was even thinking of just now. But yeah, you have a great point. I mean, this is the NHL. We keep hearing about, oh, they'd love to expand. The NHL would love to expand into Europe. Maybe do, you know, have some games over there. Blah blah blah. And the KHL is kind of realizing that on their own and really changing the face of hockey, not just for Europe, but for the NHL as well.
Right. Especially on the heels of the story that was on the hot stove on Saturday that the NHL wants to bring either six teams this year or and then eight teams the next to Europe, and the NHLPA, excuse me, is balking at that. So the NHL wants to expand their presence in the beginning of the season, playing regular season games in Europe, to as many as eight teams by the 2010 opening season.
Wow.
I guess they're going to play around Robin. I don't know what the situation is, but I would imagine that they're going to play upwards of four games, and you know each of those teams will play up to four games over in Europe. It's a lot. You
Do
know?
You think that this maybe is something like the NHL trying to think that they are overselling too many games to our market? Do you think that maybe they're realizing in a way that a 76-game schedule might be a little more viable at the gate without actually rolling back to a 76-game schedule?
Game schedule? Well, I don't know. Maybe. That there's money in Europe that we're just not going to – there's revenue in Europe that's potential that's there that they're just not going to capture here because of 41 home games. Now, if the – you know, the teams that do those, you know, the play those games over in Europe are only going to be selling, you know, 40 or 39 game season ticket packages, which, you know, in light of a major economic downturn may not be a bad idea.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, maybe that's what they're trying to be proactive and preemptive in how they stabilize their revenue stream by trying to tap into, you know, European revenue. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Or it's also a flanking maneuver for the KHL. You know, you make a bigger presence in Europe. You got more of these players to play in front of their hometown audiences. It gives them
maybe
less of an incentive to play in the KHL and take possibly even a lesser salary to play in the KHL closer to home.
It's suddenly the KHL is turning into a viable alternative for some players, and you know, not just the cast-offs that we all kind of laugh at. I mean, there's the Ray Emery and Robert Esch over there, but at the same time, you know, Yager decides he's done with the NHL for now and goes to the KHL to see how that is. And, you know, even though nobody was offering Alexei Yashin any contracts, he's a viable and big player over there right now.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the
Russian players are, the KHL from a couple of different standpoints, you have many of the Russian players who are currently in the NHL are at least hoping that the KHL is viable so that they can go home and play the style of hockey that they would prefer to play. That's the rumor surrounding Max Finneganoff, and is part of the reason why Darcy Rehier can't move him.
I don't want Max Finneganoff to leave the NHL just because I love yelling his name. I love yelling it out loud in long soccer goal kind of yell.
Maxim Finneganoff. Yeah, I mean, especially
Finneganoff. It's the best.
Especially when Rick Tenorette actually calls it. But you know, he's only scored two goals this year, so he doesn't call it all that often, except for Finneganoff going to the box for hooking.
You can't really make a big deal out of that.
No, even Generac can't find a way to make that exciting.
That would be hilarious, though. I would love to see that. Yeah, you know, the KHL is just such an interesting area right now. It's not only are they started up and immediately were a threat to the NHL. They steal players, quote unquote steal players, and then the global economy goes in the tank, and here's the KHL being hurt by it more than any other league right now because they are a startup, because they don't exactly know how it's going to work out.
Yeah, they're right on the margin. I mean, economically speaking, they're a marginal, a marginal cost to
absolutely
a marginal expense, and that's where they wind up being. But the biggest, and then of course the biggest, we can't talk about this in any way, manner, shape, or form without talking about the Cherepanov tragedy, which is it's almost unspeakable to what happened to the poor kid, and that in a sense, you know, what could have been a very preventable situation, a la Yuri Fisher, here in the States. The kid's developing in Russia. Yager, kind of part of the reason why Yager went to play in Russia was to help Cherepanov progress and develop into a NHL quality player, while his own salary issues within his salary structure and whatnot, as he talked about in the GDUB interview that the GDub posted about a month ago. And then this just absolutely horrible thing.
Oh, absolutely. Happened,
right as the season starts. So
I remember going to the NHL draft in Columbus, and I was sitting with the Acid Queen for the first round, and we're all just wondering when Tarapanov is going to be taken because as we all know, the transfer agreement with Russia was over, and every player from Russia was kind of in jeopardy of their NHL careers, and he was really the guy we were watching. It was him and Angelo Esposito, and wondering how far he would fall, which I believe was 20th to the Penguins at the time.
And
it was interesting. And now, you know, this is kind of the outcome of that. It's tragic and it's wrong, but it's sad the way that it ended up.
And you know, but the Tarapanov draft situation is indicative of everything else. There was not a Russian taken this year in the first round again. There's less than a dozen. I think they're down to 7 Russian players in the NHL right now.
Wow.
It's not many. That number may not be right, but it's in that range, somewhere between 6 and 12 players. It's not a lot. They're not getting drafted.
Well, next time I have Dmitry Chesnokov on, I'm gonna ask him about that.
Right.
That's a really good point.
You know, and that's the other major effect that the KHL and the feud between the IIHF, the NHL, and Russia, the Russian Hockey Federation, have had. You know, that feud that's been going on has really hurt, in many ways, hurt the relationship between the Russian prospects and the NHL scouts. And so, yeah, there's not a lot of scouting going on in Russia right now. There's not a lot of money being spent over there by the NHL. So, you know, I don't expect this situation to change much, you know. And it seems that we've come full circle again and almost kind of have our own mini Cold War again between the NHL and the Russian Hockey Federation. So,
well, hopefully it'll turn out for the better, this Cold War, actually. So that's what I have.
A little too destructive for my taste.
Yeah. That's what I have for my top list. I think, you know, does that kind of line up with yours somewhat? Or
yeah, I think it does. I mean, I don't think we can really. I mean, yeah, I don't think there's really. I think those are the big ones. I mean, you've got the little things like Marian Hossa going from the Red Wings to from the Penguins to the Red Wings, and then going on catching a complete fire. And little stories along those lines. You've got the interesting thing about the Joe Thornton trade 2 years out, and how now San Jose and Boston are now both the two best teams in the league. And you have to ask yourself, was that like the best trade ever for both teams?
Heck, for hockey, if that had happened within two original six teams, or if that happened between the Rangers and the Red Wings, they'd be bathing in money right now in the NHL.
Oh, I know. But and it's not bad that it's. I mean, don't get anybody wrong. San Jose is a very strong hockey market, and you know, they got good culture out there, and those people support their Sharks well.
Yeah, so, well, they better. I mean, they are the best team right now. Well, you know, tied in the points with the Bruins, and and they're not looking back. Neither team is looking back right now.
No, not at all. Not at all. But even though the Bruins have hit a little bit of injury trouble recently, but they're filling in well. They've got a good system in place. You know, the kids are coming up into a good environment. It's very similar to what was going on in Buffalo a couple of years ago, where, you know, Buffalo could lose 4 or 5 people in a week, and they just bring these kids up and plug them in, and they would just play. It's when you're in a good situation like you've got, where you're winning every night and you've got a winning culture, you know, the kids immediately gravitate to playing within that system and playing and playing well within it, and there's usually very little drop off. So, you know,
winning is a habit, they say, and so is losing, and you can ask the Detroit Lions that.
Yes.
0-16.
Now, well, the Atlanta, you can ask the Atlanta Thrashers that.
yeah, that's true.
12-24.
Ooh, yikes.
Yeah.
Well, I had kind of not huge news for NHL, but I kind of wanted to bring up a couple quick things before we finish off here. Greg Wasinski, our Puck Daddy editor over at Yahoo Sports, made the was picked as number 100 by the Hockey News in their 100 most influential people in hockey.
Wow.
A hockey blogger was picked as on this list. That's to me, that's just amazing. That's
and Myrtle wasn't on the list.
Well, Myrtle wasn't on the list. I mean, of the what we like to call the big four, you know,
right.
it was Wyszynski that was picked. But and really, you know, amongst the four, you could probably, you know, pick which one would have been 100, which one would have been 101 and whatnot.
Right.
But it's interesting that, to me, that, you know, the way that our quote unquote new media is kind of taking, you know, it is being considered seriously.
Well, it has to be. I mean, all it proves is that if you do good work, you get the eyeballs,
yeah.
You get paid. You know, I mean, I think you get paid. You get paid in not only in recognition, but in traffic, and it's and eventually in influence and legitimacy, and, you know, and or respect. And what's also interesting is, of course, is that you're looking at a guy who, if I would presume, has pretty much complete editorial control. I know we do over at FanHouse. I mean, no one's really telling us what we should write about. They're more offering us, you know, who wants this story? We got this story out here. Who wants that one? You know, as Greg said in his interview with us, he's just getting up in the morning and looking over the landscape and plotting out his day and writing, because it's what he loves to do. And, you know, it's great to see, you know, a guy who's worked as hard as he has to get this gig and then succeed this brilliantly.
Well, not only that, to me, not only does he succeed brilliantly, not only does he get the gig, he also spreads the love around. I mean, one of my favorite parts about him is that he does his daily headlines, where he looks around the rest of the blogosphere, around the internet, around the mainstream media, and says, hey, this is also something else to look at, not just me. I wish that other people would kind of get on that a little bit more. There's one of my non-favorite mainstream bloggers, surprisingly enough, is Adrian Dater. And Dater never talks about anybody else, considers the bloggers the competition. And, you know, it's no sense of community whatsoever. And yet, here's a blogger that is spreading the love around and doesn't have to just say, hey, look at what I'm doing. And it makes a big impact, I think.
It's actually the blueprint for real success. The real success, and the reason that G-Dub is as influential as he is, regardless of whatever his traffic count looks like, is simply because his take on the league is inclusive. And that helps create a better sense of community. You can't be influential being a voice in the wilderness. You can only be influential by working, you know, all angles, and not believing, you know, that you're the sole source of rightness or the information, by being the repository of, you know, everybody else's opinion, in effect, or helping to spread that opinion around. He becomes a focal point as well, and legitimizes not only his own work, but everybody else's around him.
Absolutely. No, and congratulations to him. I know that he kind of looks at it pretty humbly. I mean, he was a little more embarrassed about it than anything else, but, you know, congratulations definitely to him.
Absolutely.
I kind of want to finish off on a little lighter note. I'm going to spring this one on you. Sandstorm over at the blog Waiting for Stanley, which is a Canucks blog. You can find it at hockey-madness.blogspot.com. Still one of my absolute favorite blogs. I would say that, like, after the big four, he should probably be in, like, the next 10. Yeah, to me. I mean, he's just really a great blogger and all that. He had a banner up somebody sent to him. Rather than Waiting for Stanley, it was Waiting for Stan Lee, the Marvel Comics creator.
And, nice.
Okay, so I must bring this one on you. What do you think? Stan Lee, Marvel Comics, the man is a salesman. The man knows how to market things. He's just a goofy, wacky character. Stan Lee, next commissioner of the NHL? What do you think?
No. Well, I mean, you know.
He wouldn't turn away from fighting.
Well, you know, Stan Lee's politics has always been kind of, you know, of the communist leftist sort. So I guess with a salary cap, and Yager would approve or not approve, because, you know, in his words, communism has taken over the NHL. But no, I, Stan Lee, no.
Come on, we could go from the original six to the Fantastic Four.
Yeah, and then, you know, the Amazing
Fighting would be up in the league, you know.
Fighting would be up in the league. Cause, you know, I guess we, you know, who gets to be the Incredible Hulk? And
I'll tell you, if you, and you know what, if you brought back Mick Magoo, you'd make him dress in a jumpsuit. I'm going to leave that.
Why did you? Yeah, that's an image I just don't want. One, Mick Magoo doing anything in stripes, and then you're going to put him in a jumpsuit? No, bad.
I want to leave. I wanted to leave you.
Almost worse than Cary Fraser bald.
Well, Tom, thank you so much.
All right, dude. The James was fun as always.
Thanks a lot for listening to The Rink. It's been a great time podcasting so far in 2008, and we plan on being even better in 2009. You can find my blog over at jerseysandhockeylove.com. You can find Tom's work at nhl.fanhouse.com. And, as ever, you can find The Rink at www.rinkpodcast.com. You can send us an email to rink@rinkpodcast.com or call us at 845-704-RINK. That's 845-704-7465. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks a lot for listening to The Rink.